Welcome to Venturi's Voice. I'm Ben. Join me as I chat with big thinkers, decision makers, and leaders in the world of tech. If you like the show and would like to hear more from us, give us a follow on your favorite streaming platform. Welcome to the show, guys. Today we're joined by Ashley Firth, who's head of front-end development at Octopus Energy. Welcome to the show, Ashley. It's really good to have you join us today.
Thanks, Ben.
I think to get us started, could you give us a bit of info about how you got into coding, kind of right from the beginning?
Sure, yeah, no problem. Mine probably wasn't the most conventional way of getting into it. I actually studied law at university, spent a bit of time doing that, and had a strange moment somewhere midway through that course where I just kind of could not see myself doing this as a career. I couldn't even see myself kind of getting past the initial degree that meant I was going to head off to kind of do the other qualifications and get into this. And obviously the stakes are so high in law that you really need to be invested, really any career, I suppose. But I decided that it wasn't for me, and I had to go away and have a little bit of a think about what I was going to do next. And the last thing from college that I felt truly passionate about was media. At the time, it wasn't actually web development at all. It was kind of video recording, editing, mastering, and things like that. And so the university that I went to, Bournemouth, they were also running a course called Interactive Media Production that gave you what I would call a jack-of-all-trades style approach. You tried a little bit of everything for 2 years, a bit of Unity development, a bit of Flash, a bit of design, a bit of PHP and things. And then in the third year, you got to kind of major, I suppose. You built your own kind of product or system or whatever it happened to be that you were interested in. And for me, it was web development. And so that was my first real taste of doing it. I was very, very late into it. A lot of people in the course with me had been kind of playing with things and hacking with things since they were about 12. So a heavy amount of imposter syndrome to begin with. But it was just something that really kind of spoke to me. And I was really, really into it from the moment I started. So it wasn't problematic to kind of go straight in, kind of full tilt and spend so much time doing it. If anything, I guess with tech moving the way that it does, you're probably better off not having a historical knowledge when you first start, because a lot of people were kind of having to deal with the difference between, okay, ActionScript 2 and 3, or one version moving to another and fundamentally changing the language. And I didn't really have that problem. So yeah, I spent 3 years doing that at university. And finished that. Really, really enjoyed the course. Loved the time there. And then went straight into the industry from there.
Amazing. That's really interesting how you went from doing law. And I'm just quite intrigued if you think there's any kind of correlation there at all between kind of law and tech. Or is the mindset the similar, or is it completely different and you just wanted to do something completely different?
I've never seen anyone try and draw a comparison between law and coding. I think, to be honest with you, I saw a lot of dedication from other people that were in the course in law that I wasn't able to replicate. And I knew that I'd found it the minute that I had started coding. That kind of attention to detail, the willingness to get really in to the finer details and the not so enjoyable parts so that you can truly understand something and get to grips with it. And I think doing law showed me that in other people and kind of taught me that I needed to find that. And when I was starting to hack around with things and learn things for the first time, I think that was then the kind of pointer for me that was like, cool, you might not know everything, but you are certainly in the right direction and you're kind of excited to get up, or you forget what time it is when you're first learning and suddenly it's very, very early or very late, depending on when you stop. And so I would say that that's probably, I don't have an analogy to hand that might be able to tie neatly together law and coding, but I think the way that you approach things and how you feel when you're doing them is probably universal across everything. And that's certainly what I found the moment I switched. It felt like something had been hanging over me when I had been doing law, because I think you can do something and be really, really good at it. And that's not to say I was really good, but I was doing okay at it, but had no real passion for it. And I think that kind of represented a massive shift for me. That was the moment that I was like, cool, I'm gonna do what I love every day and it's gonna be great. And yeah, I can't tell you what a relief that was, shifting from one to the other, although very scary.
Do you think there's a certain skill to to working kind of development? It's a kind of like, I know that a lot of people are kind of natural problem solvers and naturally maybe analytical. Would you say that there's a certain kind of skill that you need?
I think the skills, certainly the ones that we look for in Octopus anyway, and the ones that I found when we've been building up the team, is that the skills are less around the individual parts of coding itself and more around that willingness to learn. If you're an incessant learner about anything, you know, about reading, about listening to podcasts, gaining knowledge in some point. And I think that's probably the main thing that the last year of my course taught me, was that you will have to go and learn things for yourself constantly. In tech, there is always a new framework. I mean, especially if you're dealing with front end, there are too many jokes around how quickly you go through different JavaScript frameworks and how many get usurped quickly. And I think a willingness to constantly be questioning what you're using and what you're playing with, and even people that don't have that much experience will come in with a fresh mindset, a fresh take, and be willing to ask the questions. They don't come in kind of worried or afraid of the kind of big scary tech stack that's already there and all of the massively experienced people that have built it up until this point, because it's a constantly never-ending iterative cycle. And so if someone can come in and be like, cool, I've actually done this in this other way, is this applicable? Even to ask the question, to not feel terrified or like they aren't even allowed to ask that question. I think that's the best thing that you could possibly have, is just a willingness to think in a different way. I think it's what all teams should look for. I think it's what most do look for, is that kind of confidence to ask in that. And then even second, probably ahead of coding as well in terms of prowess, is being driven by what you're doing it for. And so there's one thing to solve the problem, and then another thing to understand why you want to solve that problem and who you're solving it for. I think it happens a lot when we focus on accessibility here, and you know how important it is to ensure that everybody can access the web in the same way. I think it's very important when you think about energy and how you can alter people's kind of financial position by being more effective as an energy company, how you can make the planet a little bit better by kind of trying to combat climate change around renewable energy and things like that. These are the things that when I talk to somebody in an interview, they're passionate about those things, and they don't know anything about the company at that point, you know, enough of what's kind of been projected from the outside and the kind of the stories and the awards and things like that. But if you come in with that genuine passion of, it feels like you're trying to combat climate change, and I want to be a part of that in some way, it feels like an important thing to me, because that's whatever somebody is working on, that's their mission, right? That's the drive that they've got at the moment. I think that's what keeps you coming in to work longer than maybe a couple of years or something before you seek a new challenge.
I'm intrigued, because you've been kind of dropping into kind of what kind of personalities you look for that work in, or that you'd like you employ at Octopus. So I've got a question that everybody seems to have a very different opinion on, and it definitely separates judgment. So would you say that when you're hiring, you would look for more of a cultural fit or a technical fit?
I think both are important. I think if you don't, if you only had a cultural fit, then it would be even trickier when someone isn't capable of doing the job that you're hiring for. I think, you know, sometimes depending on the size or the experience level that you're doing for, you shouldn't get bogged down. You see a lot of coding job descriptions where they ask for years more experience in a product that hasn't even existed for that long. I think that's always tricky. For me personally, I feel as though we code in such a way whereby I would be searching for someone that's more, feels more empowered by the mission that we're trying to do. And I think if you lose sight of that, regardless of what size you get to, you end up in a very tricky position where you're not sure if the whole company still represents the values of what we were doing at the beginning. You know, we found a design a little while ago, the very first Octopus homepage, and it had 8 promises or 8 pledges that we were making in terms of the things that we were hoping to do as a company. And I can say, honestly, they still are all viable now. They all make sense now. The 3 main ones that we really wanted to target was, you know, world leading tech, really great customer experience and battling climate change. And those are as important as they were right at the beginning, which was the whole pillar of what we're doing. So if people are truly empowered by that, and they still have to pass a code test, right? Like, you can't, I think we're talking really in the basis of, like, if someone is reasonably good at both to the point that you might be hiring someone, which one do you put more weight behind? I would put it more behind the kind of mission and state of mind, to avoid the word culture, than I would for the technical prowess, because I think if you're still kind of one of those constant learners, again, you're going to pick that up in the time that you're here. And I think mine is a pretty young team. I think the company is a pretty young company. We give responsibility at a point where perhaps others wouldn't. Or certainly historically wouldn't. And that means there's an awful lot of learning to do at all times. But if your head's in the right place, it's good. You know, you all learn together, you get a little bit better every single day, and you move from there.
Nice. That's really well put. I think for the use of the listeners, could we explain what Octopus Energy is? We just got completely wrapped up into the conversation.
Cool.
Maybe that's a
no
good
problem.
Idea,
yeah, Octopus mind. Energy is a we're going to call it a challenger energy supplier now, because we're not a small energy supplier. We're not a new entrant in anymore. But we are a domestic and business energy supplier, attempting to do energy in a way that hasn't been done in our minds properly yet. It certainly hasn't been done in the way that we expect it to from kind of incumbents, what's known as the Big Six, although there aren't really six of them anymore. But yeah, it's those same three things that I mentioned before. We build our own tech from the ground up. Many times Greg mentions us as the tech company that does energy rather than an energy company, because it's putting that new tech in and approaching the problem in a different way. So building our own software instead of taking it off the shelf. Focusing massively on customer service. So having an operations model that can scale to a decent size and keep customers happy and make sure they're not waiting on phone lines for ever and ever and never getting through. But really also with that tech, having an online platform that allows you to kind of handle things in your own way and self-serve them instead of feeling like you have to go to a phone every time you need to know something about your energy supply. And first and foremost, battling climate change. So actually investing in renewables. So having solar farms solar farms and wind farms, and investing in those sorts of things, rather than just buying certificates and appearing green. We want to actually do something about that. And I think they all come together to create the sort of products that I think in the long run are really going to change energy as a whole. Things like our agile tariff, where the price changes every 30 minutes. So you can actually start to think, typically an energy tariff really wouldn't change any more than, I mean, usually once a year. The earliest was kind of once a month or something like that. We wanted to use smart meters to basically say, it'll be cheaper to put your washing on at 10 p.m. than 8 p.m. Or, you know, maybe if you've got an electric vehicle charging, you're setting it up to charge in the middle of the night when demand is so low and supply is so high that many energy suppliers get paid to actually take electricity off the grid. And so we can pass that on to a customer. So there are customers on this tariff at the moment that get paid to use energy by us on a regular basis because of the COVID situation and lockdown. There have been large events, like 9+ hour events, where everything that they were using throughout a day, they were getting paid for, right? Those are the sorts of things that you want to see, behavioral changes in people that allow them to manage their energy a bit more effectively, know that because we're using renewables, there are times when the sun is shining and when it's not, and when the wind is blowing and when it's not, and really starting to make that change where people can take real advantage on a financial level and on a renewable level. So I've just went into one product that Octopus does, but there are a couple of sister companies. We do business as well. We've been helping people get into electric vehicles through salary sacrificing and things like that, which is great. So anything that really comes back to those three core premises, we are going for, really. But by and large, we are an energy supplier.
Amazing. That actually sounds incredible. How old is Octopus? How many years has it been?
Not many. Alive? Not many. It was technically formed in September 2015. I joined in December 2015, and we entered the market officially, past control market entry, in April 2016. So we've been in the market for 4 and a bit years.
Whoa. So, I mean, has it scaled a lot in that time?
Dramatically, yeah.
That's crazy.
At the end of 2015, there was about half a dozen of us sat in a room trying to work out how we were going to do energy, really, how to understand the network, what our kind of thing was going to be. A few of us had worked together previously in another company. So when I saw those people coming together and they said, we need someone to do front end, I was like, yeah, absolutely. It sounded like a really cool idea, something completely different and something I knew nothing about, but wanted to throw my energy into. And I mean, now we have, and the number's probably wrong at the end, but we've gone from 0 to 1.7 million customers in about 4 years. And the platform itself has a lot more than that, because we've done things like white labeling. So people like M&S Energy, people like London Power with the Mayor of London are all examples of companies that exist in the market who are powered by us. It's a twofold challenge around your own brand and building an energy company that is doing something fundamentally different in the UK, and dealing a platform, or building a platform that can deal with a vast amount of people that perhaps are not even kind of with you as a brand.
That's very dramatic scale. So I'm intrigued. It really is. I mean, I'm intrigued to find out, were you prepared for that? Did you expect it to happen?
I think if you speak to someone like Greg, absolutely expected it to happen. We all hoped that it would happen. Whether it would happen at the speed that it did, I don't know. We knew that we were doing things in the right way. And I think even if it hadn't been as rapid as it was, we still would be following through with the same mentality, the same kind of working style, because we had faith in it, and we had faith in the people that were there. I personally expected it to grow, but not at the rate that it did. To go from who are you working for again to like seeing kind of Octopus Energy vans in the street, and if you live in London, you would have seen Constantine the Octopus appear just about everywhere at the moment. And to think about that change is very, very dramatic. But because things move so quickly, you don't stop and think about it all that much. But I certainly didn't expect quite the intense spike that we've had.
Yeah, I mean, it's really interesting how the values of the company hasn't changed at all, really, has it? Since you the very beginning, is that right?
Yeah, it's stayed completely resolutely us, and I think it's fair to say that there aren't that many leavers from Octopus Energy as well, to be honest with you. Nobody has left the team since to my team personally. You know, all of the same faces that were there at the start, they're pretty much all still there. And it's all feeding in. Greg likes to call it a self-raising crane. So the people that are kind of here imparting those values, building that core idea and culture, are the very same people working with others to understand or implement that. And that works likewise. And so it feels inside it, when you're in the building, when people are together on a Friday, it feels like the same vibe. It hasn't changed. The environment certainly has. We have a little bit more room these days, and you know, there are definitely some new faces pretty much every week, which is exciting, and you want to get to as many of them as possible. But it feels essentially still like Octopus Energy. Speaking as someone from start to finish, it feels the same.
So we've been speaking a little bit before the podcast, and you mentioned that you've written a book.
Have, yes.
Could you give us a bit of insight into what the concept is?
Sure, yeah, absolutely. It was a concept born out of what we were doing here at Octopus. So when we first started, we talked about some of the things that will be important from the website of things, because we wanted to go tech only. We wanted the solution online to be better than what was currently there. And for us, web accessibility was a massive thing, because we wanted to make sure that regardless of how you interacted with the web, you would still be able to do that. Things from the past, like providing Braille bills for people that have a visual impairment, only a fraction of people with a visual impairment read Braille, so that really doesn't solve that problem. However, we're in an age now where screen readers are free on every major operating system, which means you can listen to a site instead of looking at it. And so that provides a completely different experience when you're online, thinking about how the content flows from top to bottom, what's visually there to maybe ground some of that content that you just can't see if you're using a screen reader, and how you kind of adapt and it kind of empower those users. And then it becomes this kind of rabbit hole of so many different ways. There's thinking about colorblindness and how color infers your meaning, thinking about learning disabilities and dyslexia and things like that that might infer how you do your content, and motor disabilities that might mean you're just using a keyboard instead of a mouse, in which case can you just use a keyboard to get all the way and get a quote from your energy supplier and kind of log in and things like that. These are all things I started to think about. And Greg will remember that right at the start, when we didn't really even have a quoting journey, I kind of said, look, I really need to spend a bit of time to truly understand this because it is so deep a subject. And he, to his credit, was like, cool, yeah, absolutely. Let's go away and think about this before we just rush in and create something. And so it's been a part of our DNA forever. And from starting to do that, I started to write a few blog posts. Blog post turned into a couple of tutorials for some magazines, which turned into a feature. And then a couple of years ago, I spoke at the Festival of Marketing, which is a multi-day thing, and people come and chat about a range of things. And it was the first time that I needed to explain to people that weren't developers what web accessibility was. So before, it's been, all of the books have been very regulatory and very codey, and it's like, cool, you need to tick this box and do this, that, and the other. I wanted to be able to explain to designers, product marketers, you know, product managers, what this was, why it was so important, and why everyone should be involved and not just developers. And so I did that, gave that talk, and then spoke to a publishing house called A-Press. And we started to think about, could a book exist like this that would kind of allow anybody to pick it up that had no knowledge of it, but understood or started to understand that it was a big issue, and they could go away and think about their own websites and how to be better at that. So that was as a result, and I did it around my work last year, which was, I'm not sure I'd recommend potentially doing it, certainly in the time frame. If you were able to balance them accordingly over a slightly longer period of time, perhaps it's manageable. But it was quite an intense sprint to get that done around everything that was happening at the same time. But I definitely don't regret it. I absolutely loved doing it. I love the outcome. I'm particularly happy that it's bringing other people in. So people have seen the book and have been very interested in kind of working in a team like that, that cares about those things. And even just to see, or kind of hear from customers getting in touch, just saying, you know, I felt pretty unempowered previously in terms of like other suppliers. I maybe needed to get a relative or a friend to help out when I was dealing with these sorts of things. I felt a little bit shut out. I don't feel like that now. And so that's the core premise of it, really. It's not to write a book, it's just to help people get online and feel as though it's not a selling point. So we share a lot of this stuff for free, just so that other energy suppliers or other businesses can go and make their sites more accessible. It's to get the initial things, it's very easy to get started with it. It obviously does get harder as any topic, but a lot of people could, with a small amount of effort, make their sites a lot more accessible. And then it wouldn't be a choice between, let's say, I want the cheapest tariff, but also I want to be able to handle my energy. That should never be a choice. That it has to be, I can choose between everyone, and maybe I go with this company because they're greener, or I go with this company because I like their website a bit more, or I just want the cheapest deal. Those should all be choices that everybody gets to make, and not just, you know, people that deal with the web in what many feel is the conventional quote-unquote way.
Amazing. What's the book called, just so we got that on record?
It's called Practical Web Inclusion and Accessibility. It's a bit of a mouthful, but we had to get a lot in, so it can't just be accessibility. So yeah, Practical Web Inclusion and Accessibility.
Okay, cool. That sounds really interesting. I'm just thinking about the, you know, in the past 4 years, how the tech has changed in the industry and how that's affected what you do at Octopus.
It hasn't actually. We made the decision to use React right from the start. I think it was our head of engineering, okay, David Winterbottom, decided that it was the way to go. And of course, there are many stories of choices like that that go hideously wrong. So in many respects, we're quite lucky. But the thing is, we've kind of seen enough different technologies that you kind of make your own luck a little bit. It seemed to have all the hallmarks of a very consistent and very useful framework. It was also, importantly, something that people were really excited to use. And I think that helps an awful lot. It's a bit of a hard sell to have some legacy systems and try and convince really energetic and talented coders to come and work on it. So we've been very lucky there. But although a lot of changes have happened around perhaps how you manage state or deal with things like that, really the core language has stayed the same for us. And that's true on the back end as well. Python, they use Django, and the versions have gone up, but the language has stayed. And so it's really just about kind of augmenting those a little bit to serve your purpose as you're going through. For us, it's been kind of switching over to things like GraphQL so that it can be a little bit more freed up, a little bit more agnostic in the code that we write, particularly if you think about wanting to write code that manages not only Octopus Energy, but all of the various brands, potentially countries, regions, and things like that, that it's going to have to. It's a big driver for us, but we are, I want to say, lucky, but also, you know, we did the reading beforehand that our tech stack has stayed consistent across those 4 years. But ask me in another four and we'll see where we're at from This Is Tech after all.
Yeah, exactly. So as you were mentioning, one of your USPs is a personal experience for the customer. What kind of things does that entail? So there's obviously, like, there's things now where tech is heavily involved in that. So there used to be the thing where you'd call up and, like you were saying, you'd be on the phone for hours. And now there's, like, chatbots and things like that. What other things are there that can help that? And how does tech come into it?
Sure. Off the top of my head, if you think about the most common thing that you would typically need to do before the advent of smart meters would be submitting a meter reading. You'd even have someone knock on your door every now and again if you've been particularly unstudious and hadn't submitted your meter reading, or you weren't able to access it or anything like that. We allow people to do that completely anonymously online. So we send an email reminding somebody that we need a meter reading. You can click a link. You don't have to log in or remember your password for, you know, one of 200-300 accounts that you have online. You just click the link, you submit the reading, and away you go. And that means, for so many reasons, that you have a much better experience. It means that your bill isn't estimated in any way. You don't end up accidentally falling into debt or dealing with that, although there are journeys that handle those sorts of things. But doing those sorts of things online, and certainly anonymously, is a huge step forward, because it doesn't represent a security breach in any way. And it really, you just need to get out of the customer's way. You know, there are some things that you just can automate that you just don't see a lot of. And then for things like, actually, when you do log on, self-serving wherever possible. So moving house, if you want to take us with you, you can do that online. You want to go and have a look at your usage. If you're on one of those agile tariffs and you want to see the rates, what they're going to be for tomorrow, you hop online, you have a look at that. Things like that. You want to change your tariff, you can do that online. You don't call up and speak to someone for 15 minutes where you weigh up the options. You can go and see what the deal is. We'll let you know when you come to the end of your fixed deal that you can shop around, or you can have a look at the different tariffs. We'll throw them in there for you. Things like bills. Sometimes you get an email to say that you've got a bill that you don't have to log in, and you see it, and maybe it's a PDF, so it's not that accessible. We kind of do as much as we can to put that information in the communications we send. We even have a thing around the email subjects. If it says FYI, you probably don't need to read it, but it's there for you and it's useful. If we need something from you, it says important. Please give us this. It shows a respect for someone's inbox the minute you start dealing with them, really, is that you have to send them a lot of things. Of course, we are bound by regulations the same as everyone, but it's really thinking about, okay, does somebody care? Really, does it impact them massively? We're always going to tell them, but really, most of the time, you kind of just want to know when you need to do something. And the idea being that now that we have this price cap, which obviously we worked as part of the kind of government scheme to push that forward, the idea being that you shouldn't have to switch every single year, and you shouldn't be having to keep on top of your bill to make sure it doesn't accidentally double, or, you know, something crazy like that happens. You should be able to trust your energy supplier long term. And ideally, you just kind of, for many people, they just want to give us what they need to, to make the bill accurate, and they don't want to hear from us, and that's fine. And they want to be able to trust that year on year, we may not be the absolute cheapest, but we're there or thereabouts because we're efficient and because we know what we're doing and because there isn't this huge hike between the lowest tariff and the highest tariff. These are all just part of our mentality. And I think when you do that and you think about that as a kind of a basis for all of the interactions, you start looking at it a fundamentally different way. And I think those are the things, empowering when people do want to get involved with it and getting out of their way when they don't want to be involved and they just want to pay for their energy and be okay with that.
Yeah, it's interesting because as you've been talking there, I've been thinking about the other, you know, the massive energy suppliers, and it is just like a very, it's just simple shifts and simple changes that you've made, but they're the biggest, they make the biggest difference. Like as a customer, you basically just want to, I mean, me personally, I'll just want to sign up and know what it's going to cost with like transparency and then just leave it alone and be like, that's fine forever now. I don't have to deal with that again. Yeah,
absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. I mean, to extend that one more as well, sometimes even when you know that you have to submit a meter reading, you still don't really want to sometimes, you know, it's one of those things that you have to remember at a certain part of day. And we kind of took that into account as well. And we built something called the Wheel of Fortune. So every time you submit a meter reading, you can spin this wheel and you get a chance to win account credit. So every month somebody wins £512 account credit. It's all done in multiples of eight because, you know, Octopus, it's all very on brand. But the idea being that you know, you, every time for every fuel, you can spin the wheel and there's a small chance that you'll win something back. And it's kind of rewarding the small amount of time that somebody has taken out of their day to do this thing that benefits them and benefits you. Because even though it does benefit them, there should still be something in it for them. And I think we're probably, and I don't have an official statistic, but we're probably the only energy supplier that gets complaints that they can't submit meter readings right. more often, more than a calendar month. You know, you restrict it. And they're like, well, I want to spin the wheel again. Like we looked and there was a particularly short day about 6-7 months ago. We were like, oh, there weren't a lot of kind of spinnings of the wheel there. What was there anything particularly wrong? And then we worked out it was Christmas Day. There was like thousands of people spinning the Wheel of Fortune on Christmas Day. And then at that point, you know, you've done something right. And I think those are the sort of things we try to employ in every problem that we have a look at.
Previously on the podcast, we've had on, is it the CEO?
Yes, yeah.
Like Greg Jackson, the one and only Greg Jackson.
Yeah, hard man to follow.
Yeah. He's been on the podcast just under a year ago. So since then, what's happened and what are the developments?
That's a good question. What's happened in the last year? You lose track of particular kind of points in time and what they reflect. I know for sure when Greg was on the podcast, we weren't technically a unicorn. So we managed to achieve unicorn status a few months ago, where we reached a valuation of £1 billion, thanks to our investment from our friends at Origin, which was great. That was a huge shift for us, particularly given the kind of climate as it is in general, to receive that sort of kind of backing and faith to go and do what we're doing with Octopus in different places and to think about this as a problem to solve for the whole world and not just a problem to solve in the UK. It's still a fundamental problem we want to solve here, but there are other countries that could benefit massively, you know, like Australia with their, you know, a time of use tariff would work amazingly in Australia, where there are things like kind of climate conditions that affect weather drastically and situations like that. And I think it's great to be able to go and think about those kind of problems now, whilst kind of keeping this core brand in the UK as kind of confident and moving forward as it can be. So that's great. Obviously these kind of unique situations have kind of thrown some things up. We've been hiring during this time, which is great. So the team has been built during lockdown. There are a couple of people I've hired so far that I've never technically met in person. So that is a really interesting thing and something we've all had to deal with across the board, really, is kind of dealing with absolutely lovely, talented developers who you've never technically met. I met a couple today, a couple last week. It's nice to know they're real people, you know? So that's always a benefit. So I think that was quite good. All of our systems were kind of set up to deal with a situation a bit like this, you know, not necessarily a pandemic, but the idea that if we needed to do things solely online, could we do it? And absolutely we could. You know, we never stopped answering phones during lockdown. We kind of continued. You might hear the odd dog barking in the background or something like that. But, you know, the lights all stayed on, everything kept going. And we were there and supporting people during this, which is great, because it was a time of, still continues to be a time of fear, you know, not sure what the situation is going to be. If somebody's circumstances have changed, they need to be able to talk to their supplier and deal with that. You know, we're very proud to have stayed here, kind of helping where we can. So that's been a big change, which is great. And then just lots more customers, just an awful lot more.
Perfect. That's so interesting. I think that might wrap us up today. Thanks so much for coming on the show. It's been so interesting to hear everything you've got to say.
No problem. Thank you. It's been really interesting. Some of these things I haven't thought about for a little while. So it's been fun. It's been fun.
Is there anything that you particularly want to mention before we end the recording?
No, I think I'm largely good. We're still hiring. If anybody wants to kind of get in touch, you know, Octopus Energy is where we're at. But no, otherwise it's been a lot of fun. Thanks, man.
Thanks for listening to Venturi's Voice. If you like the show, give us a follow on your favorite streaming platform.